This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. It's been 10 days since Donald Trump was elected as the next president of the United States. The day after the election, Congressman Peter Welch said he was very surprised by the results of the election.
So I think for a lot of us, it's just a stunning outcome that we didn't see coming. So it's very, very difficult to absorb.
How will House Democrats respond to the legislative agenda of President-elect Donald Trump? And are there areas where the Democrats will work with the Trump administration? These are some of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch. Congressman, great to have you back on the program.
Good to be here.
And you can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. How do you think Democrats in Congress should respond to the election of Donald Trump as president? Should they give the president-elect a grace period or fire up their opposition right from the start? And are there issues where the Democrats and the president-elect will actually agree? You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net or give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. So it's been 10 days now since the election of President-elect Trump. You've had a little more time to think about that. That clip that we had with you really literally was the day after. I think you were at the airport at the time. What do you think the major message of the election of Donald Trump is?
Well, we're all trying to figure that out. But, I mean, I just say this. I was in D.C. this week. We were all back. And the Democrats were stunned and dismayed. And the Republicans were stunned and delighted. I mean, nobody had an expectation that Trump was actually going to win. But clearly, what it says to me – let me also – remind people that Hillary Clinton got between 1 and 2 million more votes in the popular vote. But where Hillary lost the election was in three states that Democrats normally win, and that's Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. And had the votes in that state gone 100,000 the other way, she'd be president of the United States. But the reality is, and this is where I think we on the Democratic Party have to acknowledge our failure, those were working class people that the Democratic Party has traditionally identified with, and they don't believe us. They believe the Democrats haven't done the job for them, and they went for Trump. Now, the dead-end promises that Trump was making won't do much to increase their paycheck. It won't do anything at all. But in fact, we have to take seriously that these really good folks did not support our candidate for president.
So did the Democrats misread the mood of voters in places like Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania?
Well, I think the Clinton campaign at the end was playing ads against Trump based on his character and his statements rather than on economic issues and what she was offering to people to help them with the economic stagnation that is in those areas. And what you saw in this election is that – and it was a very traumatic election, I think, for a lot of Vermonters. I remember so vividly talking to people that just couldn't believe the things that were being said, what was being covered in the news, worried about whether their kids were going to be watching this or not. And what the voters clearly did with President-elect Trump is they just put all of that aside, and then he became a vehicle to express their frustration, I think, with a stagnant economy. That, and what you have in this country, and we even have it, of course, in Vermont, is that some of the areas, urban areas, are doing well. But a lot of our rural areas, our small cities, our small towns, they're struggling. And it's a function of a lot of things, globalization, migration of young people into the cities. But those are creating a lot of dislocation around the country, but especially like in the areas of the Rust Belt, in places where we had good manufacturing jobs. And my sense is that people with that economic frustration voted for the guy who at least said he was going to make America great again and create jobs. Whether he will is a big, big, big question. But that message resonated more than the Clinton message.
So people voted for change even though they're not sure exactly what that change is going to mean. At
well,
least they know it's change.
They definitely did. And we were talking earlier, and you tell me that about 60 towns in Vermont that voted strongly for Obama in the last couple of elections flipped and voted for Donald Trump. So Trump clearly became successful as the change candidate. And people, I think, what's interesting is a lot of people who want change liked Obama. They weren't rejecting his presidency. In fact, many people that I spoke to since who voted for Trump were strong Obama supporters and quite delighted with his presidency. So the message I take away is really the one that Bernie was giving. I mean, I think Bernie got it right on. We have got to address the legitimate economic concerns of everyday Americans who haven't had a pay raise in effect in 12 to 20 years. So ironically, I think Bernie was on the right message and do it in a positive way. Trump was on the right message with his populist focus, but in my view, without any policy proposals that are going to help folks.
Speaking of Bernie, we got this email from Lori, who wants to know, first of all, Lori commended you for supporting Bernie Sanders in the Democratic presidential primary. Lori wants to know, how do you feel about what the DNC did to influence the primaries and treat Bernie Sanders unfairly? Were you aware of what was going on behind the scenes? Do you feel, as she does, that Bernie actually was the best chance of beating Donald Trump?
Well, I agree with her on that. And just by the fact that Bernie really resonated with those working class voters in places like Pennsylvania, Michigan, in Wisconsin, where we lost. So frankly, I think you can make a very good case that with Bernie's message and how strong he was in the primaries, that he could have won. Now, obviously, we'll never know. And Bernie's pretty modest about it. He doesn't make any claims. But the evidence is there that we lost in places where he was strong. And by the way, it reminds me of when I went into that coal mine in West Virginia with my Republican colleague and spent several hours with the coal miners. When I came out, they were all Trump people, but they liked Bernie. And it just shows he had an appeal for folks who think who've been left behind. What the DNC or some of the people in the DNC did to put a finger on the scale was outrageous. I don't think that's what ultimately affected the election. But the DNC has no business playing favorites in a presidential primary.
Well, speaking of the DNC, there's going to be a competitive race for the leadership of the Democratic National Committee. We see Bernie backing Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison. We see former Governor Howard Dean, who was DNC chair back in 2005 to 2009, wanting his old job back. Who do you favor in this race?
Well, I don't have a vote, so I don't have to make that decision. And I serve with Keith, and I have served, of course, with Howard. And I'll just say two things. One, Howard has got to be given credit for his tenure at the DNC because he's the one who began the 50-state solution. And that is absolutely essential for Democrats to go into every community, every state, whether we're strong or not, including the Deep South. And what you've seen is that that was adopted more or less by Barack Obama. It's been adopted by I think, most of the candidates for the DNC. And, of course, Howard, in my view, did a very good job there. So he's got, I think, a real shot. Keith Ellison is my colleague, who is a progressive colleague of mine. And very, very good speaker. He's dynamic. He was an early and aggressive Bernie supporter, and there were only a few of us in the House. So I think he has a lot to offer, too. There's a big debate about whether it has to be full-time or part-time. And, of course, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was in the House and also served in DNC. Some people raise that question. Howard's raising it. Keith will have to answer that.
So you were talking about how the Democrats kind of missed the message of states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. Bernie Sanders would say he's supporting Keith Ellison because Democrats need to change the message. They need to be aware of those kinds of voters. So is Keith Ellison sort of the Democrat of the future and Howard Dean the Democrat of the past?
Well, I wouldn't put Howard as the Democrat of the past. I think he's first of all, I think he's pretty with it. You know, he gets it and he keeps up with it. Keith has gotten a lot of recognition because of his very active role in Bernie's campaign. And to some extent, the question is, what is the DNC chair to do? In my view, they'll have to work that out. Is it somebody who's a spokesperson for the party, or is it somebody who is really focused on the mechanics of making sure we have an apparatus in place? And generally, the DNC chair is not so much the spokesperson as the mechanic. So we'll see. But they're both working hard, and we're going to have other candidates, it looks like.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Jay, who's calling from Brookfield. Hi, Jay. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. This is Jay Hooper, Representative Welsh. I hope you're well. I won my election. I'm a Democrat. I was going door to door myself. So I find that the Democrats have lost touch in the voters' eyes with the working class. And I think it's time, in response to that question about whether or not Democrats should give President-elect Donald Trump a chance, or just to start out with, you know, gridlock, I think it's time to move on with these protests and all that, so that we can, you know, see how he does.
I'm not quite sure, Jay, what you're saying. If you want to have a protest, go to it. That's your right. And here you're asking a question I have to struggle with, all right? And I've been given a lot of thought. How do I deal with a President Trump? How do I do my job for Vermonters? And I think it's two things. Number one, he's the president. It's not anything that I wanted, and I'm surprised by it, somewhat dismayed. But I've got to focus on some of the economic opportunities that may be there based on things he said during the campaign. Let me give three examples where I'll be working extremely hard to test whether Donald Trump was serious. He claims he wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. We need to do that. We need roads. We need bridges. Potholes don't repair themselves. We've got to get broadband extended throughout rural America, including Vermont. We have water systems that have been in neglect. In Rutland, some of their water system goes back to the Civil War. So I am all in, and I will work extremely hard. My skepticism about Trump and the infrastructure plan is, will he pay for it? It doesn't come for free. And I'm willing to do that. Second, he said that he favors something I've been working on for years, and that's prescription drug price negotiation. The cost of medication is killing us. It's killing employers who are providing insurance for their employees. It's killing taxpayers, and it's killing individuals with their copays and deductibles. And we should be able to negotiate prices in Medicare, the biggest purchaser of medication, just like they do in the VA. It could save us about 40% on our medical bill. Third, he claims that he wants to end this outrageous loophole of so-called carried interest, whereby these Wall Street hedge fund people don't pay the same rate on their income as you and I do. In fact, they're multimillionaires, billionaires, and they pay less as a rate of tax oftentimes than their secretaries. So those are three things that are focused on the economy. I'll work really hard on that. But there's a second area where my job is going to change, quite frankly. I am extremely concerned about the rhetoric of the Trump campaign that threatens civil liberties, threatens respect for ethnic groups and for religious groups, Muslims, Hispanics. And I will be determined to resist and fight Donald Trump in every way, every day, if he tries to take away a single right from a single American citizen.
Let's go to our another caller and talk to Sue in Essex. Hi, Sue. What's on your mind today?
Yes, hi. The FBI was doing an investigation with the Trump-Russia connection prior to the election, but Comey refused to respond one way or another because it might compromise the election. He seemed to have no problem with compromising Clinton's election in regards to her emails. And it's known that Comey does have Republican leanings. This seems like a double standard. And under the Hatch Act, it's also illegal. So my question is, what's happening with Comey? And the other question that I have is, considering the people that he's putting into his administration, what exactly is the Trump-Russia connection? Because I'd like to know this prior to him becoming our president.
Well, first of all, I agree with you. I'd like to know those things too. I don't know what the Trump-Russia connection is. And of course, Trump never released his tax returns. And what is that connection? I'd like to know it. I'd like to know, too, what those connections are with some of the people that have been high level in his campaign and may be considered for cabinet positions and high level positions. Two, on Comey, I mean, it's unbelievable what he did. You know, what is it, 11 days before the election, he throws out that bombshell. And it really stalled the Clinton campaign. That's the Clinton campaign analysis of it. And then a few days before the election, it's almost as though the memo was just kidding. You know, they said those emails, there was nothing new. That was outrageous. And
do you think that tipped the scales?
I think it really had a factor because it really just stalled the momentum. And I've seen some polling that in House races where some of our candidates who were a little bit ahead right when that broke suddenly fell 2 or 3 points, enough of a margin of difference. So I think it was one of those October surprise factors that could have made the difference. But having said that, I just think that we Democrats have to acknowledge that there's always going to be some external event. And what we have to be better at is during our 2 years in our term in Congress, building a platform that gives voters reason to trust us. And these in working class voters don't. And we've got to address that.
Let's talk to Kathy, who's calling from Colchester. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And hi, Congressman Welch. I have a small little nitpicking thing. First of all, could you please refer to Trump as president-elect? He's not president yet. That's one request. But my big
well, first I will. Yes, president-elect
okay.
Trump. Thank you.
Thank you. No, I hated to even say that because I'm so supportive of you and our two senators and our Democratic Party.
Well, let me interrupt for a minute because I actually think you're making a very good point. It's tough after this election because, like, norms of courtesy and civility were so demolished. And, of course, we're used to it in Vermont. But I think your point I take very seriously, and I'm glad you corrected me. He's the president. And I don't like it. I'm worried about it. But he's the president, so I've got to treat that office with that respect that you're suggesting.
Yep. Well, I'd prefer the term president-elect because he is not the president yet. President
right.
Obama, who I highly respect, is. And I want to call the President Obama our president until we have to turn over
right.
the office. But my question is, I have huge concerns in all sorts of areas, and you are covering many of them. But the whole concept of nepotism, and I'm gravely concerned about that, and the connection of his family to being part of this and profiting, and so that is my question.
Okay, well, Kathy, thank you very much for your phone call. We also got an email sort of along the same lines from John in Jericho Center, who said, you as a member of the House Oversight Committee, will you be looking or having a bipartisan review of President-elect Trump's financial situation and an investigation into potential conflicts of interest? So you've got Kathy's concerns about nepotism and then the Trump business empire.
Well, I would support that kind of investigation, but the way it works in the House, the majority makes the decision as to what we will have committee hearings on. So we can request that information, we can request a hearing, but it'll be the Republican majority that decides whether we have it, and it's unlikely that'll happen. But I think that's a very legitimate concern. President-elect Trump says that he is going to have some ethics standards. Let's see what they are. Having your family in, here's the real concern I have with that. Are there business dealings and conflicts? They owe it to us to be very explicit and clear about that. But my question is largely competence. I mean, just because somebody's related to you and you like them and you have confidence and trust in them, his son-in-law comes to mind or his daughter, do they have the knowledge? Do they have the experience? Do they have the wisdom to make a constructive contribution to public policy? And it's hard to see where that is. So that concerns me.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we'll take a look at the race for House Democratic leadership. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. We've gotten a couple of emails about the future of Nancy Pelosi as the leader of the Democrats in the House. She is going to be challenged by Tim Ryan for minority leader. Who will you be supporting?
Well, I'm going to listen, obviously. You know, I want to say two things about this, because we'll have to make this decision in 10 days or so. The party needs change. And the party is very grateful to everything that Nancy Pelosi has done, especially when we were in the majority and we passed so much important Obama legislation. But the area – we need change on things like the seniority system, empowering members to do things. We need change in our focus on economic issues where we have a better connection to working class voters. I think all of that is really important. And that's a claim that a lot of – that's a position a lot of us are taking. So for instance, when we got back, we were scheduled to have leadership elections right away. And I was one of the people who urged very strongly that we delay those elections so the Democratic Party, the caucus, could have this discussion and come to terms with the fact that we got hammered in this election. And that process is it's underway now. And Nancy Pelosi has embraced that. She gets it. She understands that we do need to make some change. And I think we're going to be hearing from her and we're going to be hearing from Tim as to what it is they propose to do. The strengths for Nancy Pelosi that she has are significant. I mean, she's a very smart internal politician, knows how to organize things, has been very successful for us as a negotiator. The question that Tim Ryan is raising is whether it's time for a new generation of leaders. But as he candidly acknowledged himself, he doesn't have any experience in leadership, and he really never had an aspiration for it. So this is, when you're in the legislature, a very concrete decision about who can get the job done as well as what the critique is.
You talk about the need for change and Democrats need to have change. Can you have that change without changing leadership?
Well, you can, but you can. You got to see whether it'll happen. In terms of the symbolism of it, then if you change the coach, that obviously indicates that there's change. But if you have a coach who changes the game plan or creates space for new members, or we start addressing, I think, the seniority system, which is too strictly applied in the Democratic side versus the Republican side. I mean, their leadership on the Republican side is much younger, and they seem to be much more agile at putting the right place and the right person at the right time. So that's the discussion that by postponing the leadership debate we're able to have.
And you truly are undecided in this leadership vote?
Well, right now it really looks like it's Nancy Pelosi. She's got overwhelming strength, partly for all that she's done for so many members of the caucus. But what I said when we were in caucus is that we have to address this. And I'm seeing Nancy Pelosi respond to that. So my goal here is that whoever is our leader, I mean, I think the odds are very strongly that it's going to be Nancy Pelosi, given her relationships with members of the caucus. There's like 43 or 44 members from California. There's an enormous amount of loyalty from women. And by the way, Nancy Pelosi's done a really good job. The question about Nancy Pelosi is she a good spokesperson for us? And it may be that we can have other people who have ability to connect better with working class voters. Tim Ryan, for instance, could be given some kind of assignment to do that.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John, who's calling from Richmond. Hi, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. What's on your mind?
A couple of quick things. I would encourage Representative Welch to, if he can get anything done, to go for it. His approach to try to reach across the aisle prior to the election seemed to be the rational approach. Frankly, I think the question is, you know, are we worried about who's in power or worried about accomplishing something for the country? To me, that's my bias. I am an independent, tend to be in the center. So I'm not worried about, you know, who's got so much in terms of party chairmanships or whatever. I think it's all based on results. The second thing, and it has to deal with how detached or engaged members of Congress might be with their constituents, is they should be subject to the laws that they enact. Things like health care plans and all that. And frankly, I think you'd get much more thoughtful approaches to it from both sides, because everybody would be on the same page. I don't know why we don't have that now. I would suggest that as an approach.
Well, I like that approach, and as I think you indicated, that's how I proceed. I just, in fact, this last week have passed an Outdoor Recreation Act that was really sought by many Vermont bike organizations, outdoor recreation organizations, and I did that bipartisan and bicameral. We had a Republican and Democratic sponsor, and by working together, we got it done. But the other issue that is going to come up, I think, in the Trump presidency will be how minorities are treated, how Muslims are treated, how Hispanics are treated. And my experience in politics is that when people run for office and say they want to do what it is they want to do, they usually try to follow through on that. And some of the things that President-elect Trump said he wants to do, you know, extreme vetting, really raised questions about his appreciation for civil liberties of all groups. I believe that we've got to do it the Vermont way. We're tolerant. We recognize that people who are different than us are as good as us. And we have a extraordinary history of congressional representation. Go back to Ralph Landers, who stood up to Joe McCarthy, of standing up for civil liberties. People like Bob Stafford and Jim Jeffords. These have all maintained that tradition that Vermonters have a town hall, that we're going to respect people who are different from us and treat them right. And I hope that President-elect Trump doesn't follow through on some of his threats about challenging the rights of these people. But I can tell you this, I will resist it in every way I can to make certain that to do everything I can to make certain no individual loses a single right or civil liberty.
Let's talk to Philip, who is calling from Milton. Hi, Philip. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thank you for having me. My question was about the proposed Muslim ban and how Democrats plan on, you know, like Welch said, you know, protecting civil liberties and the rights of those targeted by the Trump rhetoric. But what's so glaring to me is the attack that a Muslim ban would be on a fundamental right that's in the Bill of Rights. And would that have to be brought to the Supreme Court to even use that argument? I'm worried at how someone could put that into effect. How could that even be considered?
I share your worry. But President-elect Trump has made many statements to the effect that he is going to do something quite extreme and over the top on people, on Muslims, on the basis of their religion. And a Muslim ban is something he specifically spoke about. I'm totally opposed to that. I mean, we've got an immigration system, a legal immigration system, where people can apply and we're not just going to exclude one religious group. So I agree with that. If he tries to pass legislation, we would resist it in the House. I think all Democrats would be united in that. The Republicans have the votes. They might be able to get it to the Senate. Thank goodness in the Senate. The Senator Leahy and Senator Sanders would have the opportunity to filibuster, and that's a place where we've got enough votes to block some of those extreme proposals that we hope we don't see. And then the last resort is the Supreme Court, and that's really tough because right now we've got a 4-4 court, and President-elect Trump, soon to be President Trump, is going to have the opportunity to appoint a justice, and that's going to be a fierce battle because a lot of those decisions in the Obama administration were 5-4, and a lot of the really bad ones were 5-4, including Citizens United.
Let's talk to Chris in Burlington. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Mr. Welch. Democrats nominated a weaker candidate who struggled to empathize and relate with Americans outside of their party. Who would you support in the next election that could offer the hope that Obama and Trump offered?
Well, you're way ahead of me on this. So I don't have anybody. I don't know who's going to run. I mean, I really don't. We're so far. We just finished the election, so I'll be watching.
Chris, do you have someone in mind?
I don't. I'm a true independent. I vote who I think is the more qualified candidate. But I got to say, I wrote in Bernie, but I voted Phil Scott. and you know, it's the most qualified person, and they appealed to voters' hope. And honestly, Hillary didn't appeal that same hope to me. So I was hoping, you know, Peter could offer a.
Yeah, I see. I don't know. You know, who'd have thought that Bernie Sanders was going to be a serious contender for the presidency? You know, think about it. If you'd asked me this 4 years ago, and I said I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders, you would have thought I was in fantasy land. A lot of things happen. But I share your concern about getting a candidate who speaks to our hope. I really, really admire that. That's, I think, what brings out the best in all of us.
We got this email from Alice. I am an educator, and one of my students posed this question. With all the conversation focused on pointing out ways to fear the Trump presidency, what is the end goal of this strategy? Are Americans being persuaded to disrupt and turn over the election? Is this a call for a revolution?
No. This is not a strategy. The reactions you're seeing from people, just think about how when you went out the day after on Wednesday, only just a week ago, and how you felt. You were kind of numb. Something happened that you weren't ready for. And I think that was true even if you voted for Trump. And I have just had so many conversations with people who are trying to process what does this mean. I mean, we went from President Obama to President-elect Trump, and that is night and day. It really is. And what it means is something people, and myself very much included, are trying to figure out. So I don't believe there's, quote, a strategy. I think this is always a big event when we change presidential leadership, but where we go from an Obama to a Trump, that is more than just a every day or every 4 year style change.
Today on the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. Our phone number here is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Today, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch, and our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. We got this article from Linda in Norwich. It's an article actually from the New Republic concerning President Obama and his pick for the United States Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. And what the article suggests is that there is something that President Obama can do, because right now that nominee has been bottled up in the Republican Senate. And that would be to appoint him on January 3rd, 2017. That's in between congressional sessions. And the article goes on to say, you know, Democrats ought to have the backbone to do this. It's the Republicans that are willing to challenge on filibusters. Come on, Democrats, get some backbone. What do you think of this idea?
Well, but I think as if it can be done, I'd do it. Keep in mind that the president had the authority to nominate Merrick Garland. In the Senate had the constitutional responsibility to give advice and consent, not just stonewall. They didn't even give him the courtesy of a hearing. So that was a dereliction of duty by the Senate. They wanted to run out the clock. Unfortunately, they succeeded in doing it, but it is really unfair and irresponsible, in my view, for the Senate not to do its job. So I have no idea whether that would work plausibly or what the law is. I'm kind of skeptical, frankly. But if that is something that the president did, I'd support it.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Daniel in Essex. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I've got a couple of comments. First, a proposal to rebuild infrastructure seems to be a great way to get lots of blue-collar jobs, the kind of jobs that the people in the Rust Belt are desperate to find. However, they're temporary jobs. Once the rebuild is finished, those jobs all disappear, and we're right back to square zero. The other thing that I want to comment about, or I want Peter's thoughts on, what's going to happen with the EPA and what's going to happen with the climate change moves that we've already committed to.
Well,
we also got an email from Fran in Weybridge, same subject. What, if any, progress can we make as a country on climate change for the next 4 years under a Trump administration? Do you see any opportunities, or do we just have to give up?
Well, we're certainly not going to give up. But let me go to the first question. Infrastructure jobs always are temporary. Folks in the building trades go from one project to another project. And in fact, they really object to having the argument made that the job they have is just temporary. They have kind of an insecurity. But if they're working on a bridge in Rutland and that bridge is done, what they hope is that there's going to be another bridge perhaps in Swanton. So the infrastructure initiative is something I'm really strongly supportive of. And then there's lasting benefits. You have roads, bridges, or broadband that's built out. That helps everybody else in the economy who uses those goods and services. So if we can get a strong infrastructure bill, I'm going to be all on board. And then what was the second question?
What about climate change?
Oh, climate change is in peril. The Trump promises in the campaign about the climate were basically he was going to rip up the Paris Accords. And he came very close, if not explicit, in saying that he was a climate denier and we have weather changes and that happens all of the time. And the irony right now is that having been back in Washington and talking to a lot of people in the town, many of our corporations like Duke Energy or say Green Mountain Power, they get it. The climate change is real. I think in the campaign, candidate Trump was trashing anyone who was talking about climate change as kind of a squishy environmentalist. But a lot of our biggest companies understand that they've got to change, including our energy companies. And what my effort is going to be is to try to leverage some of that support where those voices may have a little more sway with the Trump administration than some of the traditional organizations that have been advocating like the Sierra Club or National Resources Defense Council or Democrats in Congress.
Let's talk to Kim, who's calling from Brattleboro. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for your time. I guess my concern, what I've heard in this election, is the real extremist views coming from Trump. And I understand that people want change, but to hurt someone else so that you're taken care of is a concern of me. And his cabinet, Trump, is surrounding himself with extremists. And I'm not for either side, but, you know, being Republican or Democrat, but it is my hope that the Republicans, while they do have control over the House, that they will also be equally concerned about the extremist views that Trump is bringing forward. And nobody is talking about that. And that's a real concern. I think if the administration could reach out, like Obama had suggested, and say more about that we're going to be for all Americans and not condone this extremist points of views. So that's my concern.
You know what? You're so right. And you kind of take the whole complicated subject of what's going on down there and boil it down to a simple proposition. You know, treat others the way you'd like to be treated. And it really, in many ways, comes down to that. And I hope that happens because my Republican colleagues, a lot of them expressed enormous opposition to some of the extreme statements that candidate Trump made. And they are good people. And my hope is that they'll continue to speak out because they can help temper the Trump presidency. And I certainly am going to do my share on that as well.
Do you think the president-elect has the responsibility and almost the right to be able to appoint anybody he wants to the cabinet?
Well, he has the right to appoint, subject to the advice and the consent of the Senate. But the fact that he's got the authority to do it, subject to that reservation, doesn't mean he should. And one of the worst appointments that he's already made is not subject to Senate confirmation. But frankly, I'm outraged by it. You know, this Mr. Bannon, who's peddled anti-Semitic almost racist propaganda. I mean, the things he said, the things he's written are so attacking gays, lesbians, African Americans, Muslims. I mean, why in the world is that person who has that history in the White House having access to the ear of the president. I think that's outrageous. If he were being appointed to something that required Senate confirmation, I'm sure Bernie and Patrick would be fighting against his nomination. So I think the president really has – he has a responsibility to all of America. It's what that caller said. And he has a responsibility to protect the individual constitutional rights of all Americans. And that's an oath of office responsibility. So I'd hate to see one appointment after another where people have demonstrated a disregard for the tolerance that we in America owe one another.
Let's turn to Johnny, who's calling from Stowe. Hey, Johnny, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it, and thanks for taking the time, Congressman Welch, to come on. My question is really about, really getting to the core of, like, what choice Americans make or didn't make in this election. You know, I mean, obviously Hillary won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College by a larger margin than has ever happened. By constitutional, like the way it was supposed to be done is 2% of the U.S. population exists, elects 50% of the Senate, and that's kind of something we all know. But the part that isn't supposed to be in the Constitution is that the House of Representatives is supposed to be the closest to the people. It's supposed to be the most democratic House. And, you know, but if you actually, I don't know about this last election, but I know that since 2010 when the gerrymandering happened, if you add up all of the votes for Democrats for the House of Representatives, and then separately you add up all the votes for Republicans for all of the people in the House of Representatives, the Democrats have won the popular vote in the House of Representatives, yet we have a Republican majority. To me, this is a violation of the constitutional intent of the House of Representatives. And I think you're a lawyer, if I remember correctly, but why is this not a constitutional violation of our right to representation that the right. House has been taken away? And why isn't anybody actually, going to the Supreme Court with
it? Well, let me get to that. You are identifying one of the two biggest threats to democracy. One is money, Citizens United, and the other is this extreme gerrymandering, which has led to that result where the party that got the majority of votes is the minority in the House. And the gerrymandering has always been a practice. Both parties have done it. But with computers, it's gotten worse. With the divide in this country, it's gotten much worse. And when the Democrats got clobbered in 2010 after we passed Obamacare, Republicans took a lot of the state houses and went to work on gerrymandering. And what we have is a gerrymandered situation that's bad in two ways. One, the party that gets the majority of votes can be the minority party, and it's not as close to the people as the constitutional framers intended. And number two, you get these districts that are extremely right-wing or extremely liberal. And what I've seen with the Republicans is that my colleagues in the Republican Party fear a primary. They fear that no matter how conservative they are, there'll be somebody out there saying they're not conservative enough. That actually happened with Eric Cantor, who was majority leader, and he lost to an unknown opponent who basically said he wasn't tough enough on immigration. So it's the gerrymandering that is a really severe problem. I'm sponsor of legislation that would give authority to nonpartisan organizations in each state to set the congressional lines and take that power away from the state legislature.
We just got this email from Nick in Burlington. Do you support a change to the Electoral College system? As you mentioned, Hillary Clinton had a majority of popular votes or won more popular votes. Do you think it should be changed?
I'd favor majority vote is the decider as opposed to the Electoral College. I don't think we have a reasonable prospect of changing it. So I don't see that happening, but I would support it if it could happen. But I also think that while that is obviously incredibly frustrating to us because Hillary Clinton got a majority of the vote but lost the Electoral College. We've got to address the underlying challenge that Democrats face. And Bernie understood that you've got to be speaking to people about their own lives and their own communities and acknowledging how tough it is for many in the economy who've been left behind. And I think that if we do that, we can win even with the Electoral College. If we fail to do it, we're going to have these terrible outcomes.
If you change the Electoral College, would the candidates just park themselves in all the big population states?
Well, you know what? That's a good point, Bob, because, you know, New Hampshire comes early and you have the candidates there. And that's actually a good point that I had overlooked.
We'll be following how the Vermont congressional delegation responds to the policies of President-elect Trump. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for being on the program today.
Well, thank you.
That's Vermont Edition for today. Monday, we'll discuss drones. There's a lot more of them flying around out there, and they're engaged in a lot of different activities. We'll discuss their practical applications and the new regulations surrounding them. Send your questions or comments about these unmanned aerial vehicles to Vermont Edition at vpr.net, and then listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rickson Gary, Sam Gale Rosen, and Meg Malone. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.